Hello, welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Find me on Twitter, NJ27, also on LinkedIn, where I post more content. The website you can find everything is dsmsports.net, and this podcast is available on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. Let's get right into it, because this is a tremendous episode for you guys today. I was so excited to be able to speak with him. My guest on the podcast today is, you're going to hear from Alex Silverman. He is a reporter for Sports Business Journal, covering hockey and soccer specifically on the men's and women's side, and just a really good time to be talking about these two sports and what they're doing in the greater business landscape. Certainly hockey coming off a successful Olympics for both the men's and the women's, as well as the Paralympic team, as well, and how the NHL can turn some of that momentum into some growth and an opportunity for the league to continue to grow its footprint in the North America and the U.S. in particular. And of course, soccer. We have the World Cup coming. In case you haven't heard, and MLS is trying to do everything they can to ride off that wake and just. So much good stuff here coming. Here he is. So listen up to my conversation with Alex Silverman of Sports Business Journal. I am back on the podcast with today's guest. I'm so excited to be speaking with him. I can still recall meeting him in person for the first time many years ago now, it seems like, when he was, a relative cub reporter, although not really. Both of us are older than we'd like to be, probably. But I'm joined on the podcast today by Alex Silverman. He is a reporter for Sports Business Journal, covering primarily hockey and soccer. And welcome to the podcast today, Alex.
Thanks, Neil. No, great to reconnect with you and do the pod. I think it was at the was it at the Intercollegiate Athletics Forum that
It
we
was.
met? That might have yeah, I don't even remember how long ago that was, but yeah, it feels like forever ago. And yeah, good to see the pod still going.
Hell yeah. And you're crushing it with us in SBJ, as we'll talk about today. And your beats are as really as interesting as ever. This is really the year of both hockey and soccer, coming off the Olympics and, of course, the World Cup to come, among many other stories. Before we get into the meat of everything, though, Alex, tell us about you. Give us an idea of your career path, your background, your stops along the way. And what you're doing today with SBJ, and any tips for folks that want to try to do what you do.
Yeah, I got my start, really early kind of in life. I was just always really interested in or just gravitated to writing. It was something that was always a strength of mine. And so going out of high school into college, I decided that I wanted to pursue journalism. Always thought, I could always go to law school as, my backup plan if the journalism thing didn't work out. But decided to go to journalism school, and that's what brought me to from Long Island to the University of Missouri, Missouri School of
Great
Journalism.
journalism school, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not a place that ever would have been on my radar otherwise, but ended up being a great place to spend my college years. Worked at the Columbia Missourian there, covering both sports and hard news, and kind of learned through that, interned at Newsday. And then coming out of college, got my first reporting job as sort of the Sports Business Daily, which is now called Sports Business Journal Daily, but the aggregation side of SBJ. And so that's where I started and really learned a lot about, basically you become an encyclopedia of sports business. You learn the naming rights partner for every stadium, the owner of every team in pro sports, just from consuming so much content, going through the clips every morning. And that's sort of how I, started to learn about the industry, find out sort of which parts of it interested me the most, and did that for about 4 years. And then went to a media trade publication called Cable Facts and learned a lot about the media side, which obviously drives so much of the revenue in sports. But learned about the carriage negotiations and retransmission consent and all that really kind of inside baseball sort of stuff that we're seeing play out now in the RSN ecosystem. So learned that, and then ended up at Univision in their corporate communications department, and really a fascinating experience to see things from the other side. And I think that's really helped me a lot in how I kind of communicate with PR people today in my current role. And it's just given me a sense of what it's like on the inside of some of these big media companies and corporations. And then ultimately felt compelled to go back to reporting and went to Morning Consult and kind of started up their sports business vertical before ultimately making the move back to SBJ. So I've been in this role at SBJ for 4 years now, covering hockey and soccer business. And like you said, it's such an exciting time in both. Obviously, especially soccer, with it being a World Cup year here in North America. But also obviously hockey, with the excitement coming out of the Olympics and the World Cup of hockey coming back in 2028. So yeah, that's sort of the nutshell of my career.
No, very cool. And I love your insight about like really having the perspective of being on the other side of pitching media publications to write about what stories they should be covering and all that as well. I always love having journalists on also, especially in this new day and age. Like, yes, you're not that far removed from being a journalism student, but like as AI takes over now and as the media business overall becomes more challenged, like, if you were a student now pursuing a career in the space or thinking about pursuing a career in the space, like what would you do differently? What do you think needs to be done differently to train the journalists of tomorrow? Like what skill sets they need? Like, and is the media business as challenged as the narratives may have you lead you to believe?
Yeah, it's very different than when I was in school. I mean, my track within the journalism school was called print and digital news, which I assume is not what it's not offered anymore. Yeah, it's a very different world. I think I would definitely, I mean, obviously we were hearing even back when I was in journalism school about the, kind of precarious state of the industry. I think I'm one of the few people that I graduated with from journalism school that is actually a working journalist. So, I think, I would say that the narrative is real. It's real. I think there are a lot of challenges. I mean, we've seen it recently with the Washington Post and the layoffs there. SBJ is nice because it's insulated to a certain extent from that because of how niche we are, and how we are more subscriber driven in our revenue model than advertising driven.
And the events business too is very big
Exactly.
also.
Right. So we, I think you're seeing with media business is that you need to kind of just being a pure journalism play is a tough business these days. Like even the New York Times, you see with their business how diversified it is.
Yeah, games, cooking, all that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how they kind of get people into their ecosystem. So I'm hard pressed to give advice on kind of what needs to be done differently to educate journalists. But I think finding a sort of a niche area of expertise, I think, is critical, because otherwise you're just going to be, chasing the same thing that a million other content outlets are chasing. So finding your lane and really becoming an expert in it, I think, would probably be the best advice that I could give.
And who knew too that like when you were studying journalism back when or just starting your career that you would also be moderating panels or webinar series as you do at SBJ at times as well. Like it's a different skill set than just holding a figurative pen, so to speak.
Definitely. And it's not necessarily something that's come super easy to me. I think, my public speaking and, doing on camera stuff for SBJ and doing on stage stuff is something that has taken time for me to, get accustomed to. So I feel like it's gotten better and started to come easier. But yeah, you kind of have to be able to, be able to kind of operate in all mediums as a journalist these days. I mean, especially now with, people consuming things so much more through video and audio as opposed to the written word. So, I don't think you can really pigeonhole yourself as just being, a writer or a broadcaster.
Well, reps and reps, and this is another rep for you to be on camera for this podcast, as we appreciate it. And he says something that really stuck a nerve with me for sure. And that was relationships. And that's something that as much as AI is getting good and it can sift through transcripts and reports and FOIA things as well, it still comes down to relationship building and who's going to give you information and why and who you're going to be able to text to confirm something. And so as you got assigned your beats with SBJ with the hockey business, the soccer business, you maybe had some existing contacts already from your career throughout. But what's that process like? Okay, these are my beats. Now, how do I go about building these relationships? Who do I have to meet? And how do I meet them? How do I introduce myself? How do I make sure that they trust me and I can trust them? And who's most important to build up that Rolodex? What's that process like? And is it a pretty standardized process, or does everyone kind of have their own system going about it?
Yeah, I think source building, well, first of all, I think it's a little bit different than it was before COVID. It used to be, I think, a lot more in person, and I still think that is super important. Like anytime I'm in a different city, I'm trying to find opportunities to sit down for coffee or reaching out to folks to visit their offices to try and make those face-to-face connections. And get to know somebody beyond just their email signature. So I think that's still important, but a lot of networking is so much more digital now because people are traveling less to events and that sort of thing. So yeah, I think when I sort of think about my source Rolodex, I guess it's I kind of have like different contact lists on my phone. I've got like these are NHL people that I can reach out to if something's breaking in the hockey world. These are MLS people in the MLS ecosystem that I can reach out to ask about what might be happening at the upcoming Board of Governors meeting or different things around the calendar change that's happening. And then sort of have my non-MLS soccer people for things around the World Cup and NWSL and the sort of the European clubs that are coming over here and doing tours. So yeah, it's a lot of kind of different buckets that, especially because I have, sort of two beats, two different sports that I have to sort of navigate. And then, obviously within those you have team executives, league executives, brand and sponsor executives, folks, on the media side. Yeah, I think for me, it's been kind of trying to cultivate contacts, kind of a broad level, and then over time meeting more people and deepening it. But I think being able to kind of cover all your bases has been sort of my strategy.
And you kind of have that sort of whether it's a literal or a mental checkbox, like, okay, I have some marketing people, I have some sponsorship people, I have some TV people, I have some brand people. Are you checking boxes? You got to make sure you have people in various categories, or is it just kind of happen through, organically as you chase down stories and people just kind of come into your wavelength?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, but and obviously there are certain verticals I would say that are, I prioritize more, like having team contacts tends to be really useful for, a variety of things because they're dealing with obviously league level matters that kind of trickle down to the teams, and all the commercial matters also affect the team. So I think team level people is sort of the one where I've tried to be like the deepest in terms of my sourcing. But yeah, I definitely try and at least have some, one person or two people that I can call in sort of each of those areas you mentioned to bounce things off of or ask a question about something that's going on.
And do you find too the storylines affect clubs and not just sports, I guess, but clubs differently because there's so many such different resources, so many different markets. Do you have to be like, okay, well, I talked to I won't put names on necessarily, because I can't be certain that this club is really well resourced, or they're part of a multi-team ownership group, so they don't have to worry about this quite as much as this other one who's barely able to make payroll or whatever. To some extent, is it almost like different worlds at times, and you have to make sure you get all those perspectives?
Totally. It's been the most, it's come into play the most, I think, with all the reporting that I've done over the past year on the MLS calendar change. And sort of all, I mean, some of the broader changes that they're looking at around rule changes, because you have geography comes into play with the calendar change and the weather.
Yeah.
So you want to have contacts at, those northern teams that are concerned about the winter stuff, and then, the warm weather teams who are super excited about the change. You want to have contacts at, like, sort of the big market teams that, like you said, are well resourced and are super eager to see the roster rules opened up, and so that they can invest more and build, globally competitive teams. And you also want to have contacts at teams that are more conservative and, like the salary cap and the rules kind of the way they are, so you can get, those varying perspectives. So I think MLS in particular, there's just such a wide range of situations. I mean, you have people that have come into the league at such staggeringly different expansion fees or valuations,
Yeah.
and that really shapes the way, they view their goals. And but ultimately they have to kind of come together and make these decisions that affect the whole league. So yeah, I definitely think you want to have sort of a broad range. Obviously you can't necessarily have a contact at every single club, but yeah, having a good cross section certainly helps.
And I think it's a, and for people that are not familiar, the calendar change MLS, and you obviously know more about this than I do, Alex, but essentially they are changing the calendar for the regular season so that it more closely mimics the international kind of the European Football League, so that it makes more sense for transfers and all that as well. Like, and so when something like that comes into play, and you mentioned the various factors at play around weather and just different lifestyles overall for the players and fans as well. Like, I'm sure MLS wants you to have it. If you were to talk to Don Garber or whoever, they want to make sure that we are emphasizing the positive and why we're doing this and why it's gonna be better for the league overall. But then you also have to understand that, like, there are trade-offs. There are some things that aren't gonna be great, at least especially initially in this first go around. And so, like, how do you think about making sure that you are like, you know that there are some biased sources coming at you trying to like paint a rosy picture of this and trying to not necessarily bury the negative, but at least, obfuscate it a little bit. And yet, like, what's the process for like knowing that you're gonna help control the narrative of how various partners might see this, how, other clubs are seeing this, how other teams are seeing this, how the public sees this overall as well to some extent. And so, are you like understanding that the information you're getting is going to be a little bit, it always has an agenda to it, and maybe that your experience being on both sides of the picture can come into play a little bit here as well. So like, what's it like kind of sussing through a story where you understand that the way that you portray it and the way that the things that you emphasize and angles you go after are really kind of subjective in many ways?
Yeah, obviously there are, I've been on the other side as a PR person and trying to paint things with, in a particular light, to make it seem as rosy as possible, like you said. I think with the calendar change, there was sort of a general, agreement that this will be good for the league as a whole. I think
Yeah.
most owners, even the teams that were like, okay, this might not, like, we might have to overcome some hurdles associated with this. It might cost us in the short term with ticketing revenue for, because the schedules change isn't favorable to our weather or infrastructure that we have to invest in. But I think everyone kind of appreciated the positive impact of being, having the transfer windows aligned, having the international breaks aligned with FIFA and the European leagues. So that part, I don't think it was as much of an issue. The part that I think where, maybe the official narrative and the reality maybe diverged a little bit was about just the process through which this change came about. There were a lot of people in league circles who felt, the time to do this change is coming out of the World Cup this summer. And I think that was the league's goal. And ultimately, they weren't able to make it happen in time. And I think a lot of people in the league, in league circles, see that as a missed opportunity. Obviously, the league, Commissioner Garber and the league's PR have sought to kind of downplay that angle. But it's something that we've, felt compelled to, bring forward. So it's sort of you definitely take what you definitely consider what the league tells you and the whoever the official story is tells you, but you have to kind of consider other viewpoints and make sure you're bouncing what they're telling you off of other people who might not have the same agenda. I think you definitely have to have a strong, you have to have a strong smell test when it
Yeah.
comes to, taking the official line from any sort of governing body, league, team, whatever.
Yeah, and that's one microcosm of a story, and could have been. We could also just go into like the MLS and Apple TV, or I'm sure if, like they will tell you, "Oh, we're so happy in this relationship," but then you see like maybe there's some things under the hood that they're not saying around. Whatever, like deciding to end the agreement earlier than it was anticipated, or taking away the extra paywall or whatever.
Yeah, the Apple TV deal has been one of the most challenging things to cover because, MLS will come at us with some numbers that, clearly don't conform to the usual reporting standards that we expect with numbers. It's not an average minute audience for a specific event. They'll just kind of be like, oh, we had 3.7 million viewers this past weekend across all of our platforms and stuff. And so, a lot of times I kind of pat leave it to Austin Karp, who's like our ratings expert, to decide what's sort of worth us reporting on that front and what isn't. But it's tough because that other outlets are going to sort of mimic whatever the league says, and you want to provide the appropriate context to our readers. So that yeah that everything around the Apple deal has been tricky. It's new territory, and obviously even I think the most staunch proponent of the deal would acknowledge that it hasn't necessarily gone 100% as planned. So, I think we've done a good job with balance on that. And it'll be interesting to see now that the deal is shorter, how they kind of choose to pivot from here.
And we'll see if they get any lift from F1 being on there now too. I mean, obviously F1 made that decision knowing how MLS things went with them, and certainly the World Cup coming out of it. We'll see how that kind of bumps as well. And it's a fascinating story to watch, no doubt. And when it comes to like the stories that you're writing on behalf of, or not on behalf of, but covering teams and leagues and whatnot, like who do you think that they are most interested in? Like who kind of like honestly leads the narrative, but is like kind of the main mover of whether this league or team is being successful now. Like when you talk to an MLS or an NHL or name your USL even, or PWHL, like is it we are growing in sponsorship, or we are growing in TV viewership, or we are growing in social? Like how have these narratives kind of evolved over the years, and what do you think is best sort of like surface level stuff, like, oh, look at our follower growth is huge, or our video views are huge on social, but that may take away from the traditional viewership, or vice versa. Like, what are kind of the storylines that you see as really indicative of success, and what are the leagues typically pushing as well? What are the like main stakeholders actually care about?
Yeah, I mean, I very rarely will report on something like engagement is up X percent or our views on social media. I mean, the exceptions that I can think of are like when Inter Miami signed Messi and they grew their social following across their platforms, to become one of the top most followed sports teams in America. But on the whole, we try to as much as possible to ground any sort of growth story in hard numbers related to revenue, TV viewership, the number of partners on board, et cetera. Like, kind of trying as much as possible to look at business metrics and a lot of times they'll just be, press releases will obviously be very, very selective in what they include, and we'll try and follow up before we just, regurgitate that to, can you give us a little bit more on, what this number means, or can you give us more detail on you say that revenue's up by how much or that sort of thing. So I think it's I think a big part of what we do at SBJ is just kind of going that just extra level of scrutiny before we kind of just push it out there. I mean, there's no place I think that you see it more than like in viewership numbers, because the spin that you see from media companies on these things, and then everybody on social media kind of can interpret the number in some way to fit their whatever their agenda is. So most of the viewership stuff, we like I said, I leave to Austin Carp, but I just think for us, it's going that extra level in terms of applying scrutiny to some of those claims.
What's fascinating too is that like I can see how one can make a multi-sided argument where they are saying, well, our fan base is very young. Young people t don't tend to watch as much live games. Therefore, our viewership story is not the story we should be looking at. We should be looking at this story instead, or whatever it might be. And so like I can see different ways to sort of spin things. And but that's the thing too, is it can be a spin, and everyone wants to paint a positive, rosy picture of things, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that argument is fair, but I also think we're gonna find out, how can you monetize the attention from younger people the same way that it's been monetized through kind of traditional media for so long? Like, it's great if you have a lot of people, watching your highlights on social media, but the revenue associated with that isn't the same as the revenue associated with live rights. And as we're sort of seeing media companies be more selective with where they're spending their revenue, you're kind of starting to see more properties. Like, you see all these new properties popping up, and there's sort of, I think, like, the main revenue streams for any sports property are basically media, ticketing, and sponsorship. And in a lot of cases, there's just not really, there's not media revenue to be had. So, I think that's sort of the challenge with people who are saying, oh, well, that's not really the best way to evaluate our property. But it's basically, it helps to try and get a sense of like what their business model is, how much of their revenue comes from media versus sponsorship versus ticketing and game day revenue. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of kind of things to consider there, but
And then I'm sure that like the PWHL thing is an interesting example of that, who's
for
basically
sure.
getting no media revenue in the US really right now, but is crushing it when it comes to Gate and to some of the sponsorship as well. And so it's interesting to see those stories play out.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe there is a model where you don't necessarily need media revenue. Significant media revenue to be viable long term. I mean, their expenses at the moment in terms of salary aren't as high as more established men's leagues. But if they kind of intend to keep growing player salaries, which obviously is a goal, ultimately, yeah, you'd like to see them have some significant media revenue.
And so we are coming off some really positive stories. And really, if you go back to even the Four Nations for hockey, almost like over a year now, and we're gonna have the World Cup give soccer a nice lift in this country. And we had the Olympics, obviously, both the men and the women taking gold. Hell yeah! And great metrics, great numbers, even without me having to wake up at 5 a.m. on here on the West Coast to watch the men. And so when that happens, like first, I imagine the Four Nations kind of almost took the NHL, not by surprise necessarily, but maybe a little bit by surprise about how big it was. And so when these both expected and unexpected spikes in interest happen, like what are these teams doing? What are these leagues doing to make sure, and this goes for the World Cup as well, and the anticipated bump, what are they doing to make sure that it has both short-term results and gains and long-term gains? What are the metrics that, what are the things that you're going to be watching? What are you already seeing in the marketplace? And what should we look for both short term and long term to know that these bumps are going to drive some sustainable long term success?
Yeah, it's super interesting, and I kind of count myself as somewhat of a skeptic of whether these international competitions lead to interest in the sort of core product. And I think obviously that was the perception of the NHL owners for a long time. That's why they stopped going. That's why they stopped sending players to the Olympics. They didn't really feel like what they were getting out of it. They thought it was sort of outweighed by the disruption to the season and the risk of players getting hurt. So they weren't really seeing the lift in ratings or ticket sales or sponsorship growth that they felt, they needed to see to make it worth it to them to send their players over there and stop the season. The difference this time could, with the US winning this time for the first time in since 1980 and the first time in the NHL player era in the Olympics, that could be different. Obviously, this team has gotten a ton of attention. There's been a ton of buzz, positive and negative. But any publicity, I think, is good publicity for the NHL. But yeah, I'm
Was the NHL ready for it? Like, did teams have like? I mean, yes, you might see some like ad hoc, like we're gonna celebrate the gold medal winners when they come into our arena or when they come back home. Like, were teams like ready? Like, we're gonna have some promotions coming out, or we're gonna have some first time game attendee deals, or like, how did you kind of see both the preparation as well as just the execution now that we are some weeks removed from it?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue is that they're so limited in what they can do in terms of using intellectual property associated with the Olympics. This has been a complaint of Gary Bettman and the NHL owners for a long time, and I think they're probably in a good bargaining position now to maybe get the IOC to play ball a little bit more on that front because of how successful this year's tournament was. But yeah, I mean, I think I don't necessarily think that a lot of teams had, strong plans going into it, about how they were going to capitalize on it. But I think you have seen some in some markets where there was available, seating inventory. You've seen some attendance bumps, and they have seen some slight viewership upticks, I think, in the weeks coming out of the games. So I'm curious to see what the playoffs this year, how they do on TV. And I definitely think it's good for the league to participate in these things, but I think they're obviously a lot more incentivized to do so when they're able to kind of get direct revenue upside out of it, in addition to the sort of like building the fans of the future, which is why I think they're super excited about how Four Nations did last year, which is a tournament that they control, and why they're bringing back the World Cup of Hockey in 2028. I think I think the biggest opportunity for them to see direct upside from this Olympics is now they're going to be selling sponsorship for that World Cup of Hockey in 2028. They're going to be selling the media rights for that World Cup of Hockey in 2028, and I think the league will see good. They have good data points to point you to from the last 2 years of international competition to say, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily always watch the NHL who are interested in watching international hockey, and now, we're selling international hockey. So, but yeah, I think the verdict's still out on whether it'll increase interest in the core product.
And how about on the soccer front? I've been asking folks for a while now of like, we all keep talking about, oh, so this is going to be the next era of soccer in the US and it's going to change everything. And I'm like, okay, well, it that doesn't happen unless people actually do something about it.
Right.
And you had an article recently in SBJ that kind of rounded up a handful of things that clubs were doing between fan fest and ticket deals and all that. So give me an idea of what you're seeing in terms of preparation and what we should be looking out for in terms of making sure that World Cup interest does lead to at least something of a tangible bump for Major League Soccer.
Yeah, I think, the league as a whole is doing a sort of league level marketing campaign that they're putting, somewhere between $15 and $30 million into collectively, which they're saying is the most we've ever spent on marketing in any given season. Which, I think it's something. I think there are people who feel like the league should be doing maybe more than that because of how generational this opportunity is. But that's sort of the league level plan. You know, they'll have promotions during the World Cup on Fox, and they will be restarting their season in that window between the semifinals and the finals to try and capitalize on interest in soccer there. And then, you know, in the individual markets, clubs are, you know, to varying levels, have plans to host watch parties and sort of capitalize on it that way. The Chicago Fire are spending $2 million or so in their market on just a month-long watch parties and that sort of thing to get people who are maybe, you know, just kind of checking out soccer for the first time, give them a place to go. And it's a good touch point for them to, you know, with the club, and they can get people's data, you know, people into their databases and that sort of thing. So I think there are efforts there. I think there's a little bit of question about, like, are we doing enough? Is this going to have the sort of impact that we had hoped when it was awarded back in 2018? You know, I hate to just, you know, say like, oh, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but
But
you know,
it
that's sort of where I'm at right now. Like and you know, there's just been so much around this World Cup that nobody could have really predicted,
will.
or nobody was really thinking about when this was awarded in 2018. You know, the sort of the funding issues at the host city level and the geopolitical issues around it that have you know, just sort of changed the tenor of things around the World Cup. So, and maybe, you know, we'll see if it impacts how many people come over here and visit for the World Cup. So it's just such a fluid situation with the World Cup. And I think it will be the sort of I think there will definitely be a bump in interest in soccer. It's just a matter of, like you said, can MLS in particular capture it, or will that interest sort of just be funneled towards the EPL or Liga MX or La Liga, UEFA Champions League? So I think they need to convince people basically that this is something you want to experience in your backyard with your hometown team.
And I mean, and some of the best players on Team USA, you won't be able to see them in MLS. I mean, some of them you will,
Right.
but some of them you won't. And
Correct.
so I'm curious to get your perspective on how we look at soccer in the US overall, like it and how you think about it from a reporting perspective. Like, does ultimately are we just trying to grow, or not we, but like the soccer complex, whether that's, US soccer or even how MLS looks at it, are they happy if there are more soccer fans, even if they're not yet MLS fans, and they see that like EPL or La Liga or Champions League can be a funnel to MLS? Or are they really trying to create MLS fans and they're trying to sell MLS more than they are soccer, or as much as at least?
I think it's important to get, you know, every soccer fan in the US to have at least some level of interest in MLS. Like, it is not really, and this is maybe more my opinion than I know you're asking about how they view it, but I don't think it's really sustainable to have a significant chunk of soccer fans in the US, you know, basically be indifferent to what's happening in MLS and only want to focus on what's happening in the European leagues. You know, there are diehard soccer fans that aren't interested in MLS, and I think they need to change to find a way to change that. And I think that's part of, you know, what they're hoping to do with by opening up the roster rules, something they've been talking about for a long time, and just improving the level of talent here. But that's obviously an expensive endeavor that, you know, may or may not ultimately pay dividends, because it's gonna, you know, you're not gonna get to be the top soccer league in the world. You know, if you can, you know, well, getting yourself up to, say, you know, seventh or fifth make you a more compelling product to soccer fans in the US? That's sort of the question of what they're weighing with, you know, is it worth investing a lot more money into players? But I think, you know, so I think it's both. I think they view it as rising tide lifts all boats with soccer interest. But I think there is also a realization that, you know, we need to do more to make our product appealing, you know, to people who are interested in soccer.
If you take a step back, like what is MLS's brand pitch and marketing pitch today? Like, and is it consistent across clubs, or is it kind of each club on their own to some extent because the fan bases are different? Like, MLS, to your point, they're not able to say with a straight face that we are the top league in the world. That's not where you see the top talent. You see a lot of good players, and it's a great product, especially in person. But like, what is the branding and marketing of MLS today? How has it evolved, and where do you think it's going?
Yeah, I think a lot of their marketing, I mean, obviously, a lot of their marketing has focused on Lionel Messi over the last few years. He's been front and center with good reason. He's, what you've seen Inter Miami do has just really like shattered what was previously thought possible for an MLS team. I mean, they're generating over $200 million in revenue, so they're showing that like there is a path. And now, granted, there's only one Lionel Messi, but they're showing that there is, sort of a path to being, a major moneymaker in as a soccer team in the US. But across the league, I feel like the marketing pitch has been around the passion in our stadiums, the supporters culture, representing your hometown, and there's been a few star players that they've been able to sort of point to with Messi and Sun Yung-min and Thomas Mueller coming over. Jaime Rodriguez now coming over to Minnesota was a good get for the league. But yeah, I think a lot of the marketing has focused on the supporter culture and sort of the in-stadium atmosphere, which I think nobody's really questioning. It's just they need to find a way to get people to watch on TV. I think Jimmy Haslam, the owner of the Columbus Crew last year, said at Leaders Week that he said something like our media revenue from the Browns is $400 million a year, and our media revenue from the Crew is $4 million a year. And as long as it's right now it's sort of an in stadium product, and they do a lot of teams do well in terms of filling their buildings, but becoming a kind of a bigger business and doing more than just sort of operating on thin margins will sort of depend on creating broader appeal and becoming more of a media property.
How healthy is the greater soccer media or MLS media ecosystem right now? Like, are there a lot of podcasts and shows that are arguing about like which club is going to win the top of the table, who's underperforming, who's overperforming? Is that an area of opportunity for MLS, or is that not really moving the needle too much, or is there much of it out there?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been thinking a lot about this recently, because MLS, doesn't get a lot of mainstream media coverage. I mean, they're not talking about MLS, especially since MLS, not that they necessarily were when they had the deal with ESPN, but certainly now they're not being talked about on First Take or any other kind of ESPN studio shows. So they really are dependent on some of these other more independent media outfits to kind of generate buzz and conversation around the league. I think there's some of it out there. I think they could use more of it out there. And I think a lot of the independent soccer stuff that is out there, does tend to focus on Europe. So I think there's still some work to do there. So yeah, I think there's still some work for them to do there.
And you mentioned like the bumps they get from the big name players coming in. Are they happy with that strategy? Is that ultimately like a strategy they're cool with for now, bringing in these guys who are not quite past their prime, but not in their prime necessarily either, coming over. And you mentioned Thomas Rodriguez, you mentioned Thomas Mueller, obviously Messi. Like, is that going to be the foreseeable future? Is that going to be the sort of the continued like plan or strategy? Like, let's keep on bringing in these top name players that already have name recognition, or is there like a concern or something around like we need to make sure that we are developing players that come up through these academies or are MLS from day one, and are there success stories they can point to? Or is there a plan in place to, and how important is that to the future viability of MLS, I guess?
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, you're seeing teams invest a lot in their academies. What they've done with MLS Next Pro over the last 5 years with the creation of that league to create more homegrown talent. I think, but part of the issue is that a lot of those guys, you'll develop them, but ultimately they want to be sold on to Europe if they're, of that caliber. I just think, we've talked about it, like with them not being the top league in the world, I think they really have a challenge with marketing to general sports fans, and obviously, as we discussed, even some soccer fans in the US.
Yeah, and it's kind of like you can get that money from having big transfers for your best players going to Europe, but and it's hard to turn that down as much as you may want to try to pay them here, but you have salary caps as well that come into play, and it's a tough formula for sure, equation rather.
Yeah, I do think that if they, I think having super teams like Inter Miami and LAFC, having a few teams that, can legitimately compete on the global stage would be very helpful for MLS. I mean, with the Club World Cup coming here last year, it's really the first time that MLS teams have had the opportunity to compete in meaningful games against top European clubs. If Inter Miami went out there and went toe to toe with PSG in their round of 16 match, I think that would have been a big statement for MLS.
Right.
And I think, having those super teams is really good for the league, and being competitive on the global stage would be a boost. And I think that'll require them to kind of open up their roster rules a bit and let the owners that want to spend money on building globally competitive teams do so.
Yeah, I mean, we saw something at a smaller scale, to be sure, but with Any Bazell, of course, like helping to keep Tranny Rodman here stateside. So, but. Something along those lines potentially. Just a couple more rooms left here with Alex Silverman of SBJ. Alex, I could seriously geek out on this stuff all day with you. I want to touch a little bit more on hockey. We talked a lot about soccer. Now I'm a big hockey guy myself coming up in the sport. And so like I want to talk about a little bit of what's going to move the needle for hockey and really leaning into the player marketing side of it all. I think we've seen with the Olympics some of these characters come out a bit, and now everyone kind of knows who the Hughes brothers are. Everyone kind of knew for a while, maybe perhaps, who the Tkachuk brothers were, and we see other names come out, whether it's these young guys like a Matthew Schaefer or Macklin Celebrini, and hockey players for a while, by nature, by design almost, have been very boring, kind of. You look at Nathan MacKinnon or Connor McDavid or even a Sidney Crosby. They're really good guys. They do a lot in the community oftentimes, but they are not necessarily the most dynamic interviews, let alone like trying to build brands on YouTube or on TikTok or whatever. And so like how important is it? And this goes even for MLS potentially as well. We see the most successful leagues tend to have really strong players that are out front, and it's more about superstar driven culture and player driven marketing. And so how you seeing that play out with NHL? Like, are there players that they know that these guys are the characters that we can ride on? How much does it have to do with like who's going to actually be winning cups? And what kind of efforts are these leagues overall, both MLS and PWHL and NHL and the leagues you cover, are doing to really put players front and center? How important is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a discussion of, it's been a discussion as long as I've been a hockey fan. Like, how does the league make more, make its top players into stars? And, you've got a crop of players coming up, and, kind of the current stars of the league even that are super marketable, I think, with, I mean, Connor McDavid, maybe not the most dynamic personality, but, guys like Auston Matthews, Nathan MacKinnon, and then the younger guys like you mentioned, Celebrini, Bedard, Schaefer, like those are guys that should be immensely marketable. And Schaefer, for example, is a small thing, but he did this deal recently with Noble, which is Tom Brady's athletic wear company. Like, you're putting him kind of in the same stable of athletes as guys that play in the NFL and guys who play in the NBA. I think that sort of thing helps, establish relevance for NHL players. And I think you're going to see more of that. I think, into the opportunities where they can get those individual endorsement deals with sort of companies that have visibility beyond just the hockey sphere will help boost their profiles. Like, I can't, I'm trying to think of an example. But like if an NHL athlete is doing a deal with Nike for, training wear or something like that, obviously it's not as endemic as, a basketball player doing a shoe or something like that. But, those kind of crossover opportunities, I think, will be the sort of things that can help kind of propel the star power of NHL players. But, I think they're headed in the right direction. I think the challenge with hockey has been the same challenge as always. It's just that like participation in hockey is still fairly niche, like if you're a hockey, if you grew up playing hockey, you understand like how incredible some of the things that these players are doing on the ice are, and you're just, more exposed to it. I think the Olympics went a long way in getting people that might not have necessarily been watching to watch. There's been a lot of talk about whether something like heated rivalry will get more people interested in hockey. I think anything that gets hockey more into kind of the cultural zeitgeist is helpful. And I do think that, you've seen a little bit of a heated rivalry bump and, an Olympic bump. So creating those kinds of moments where the players can sort of break out beyond just the NHL sort of media bubble is helpful.
I mean, although it's unlikely, they could use a Devils run to the America's run to the Cup and maybe get Tate McRae in a suite or something.
I mean, honestly, that I feel like I've seen less about the Tate McRae, Jack Hughes relationship. Like I kind of expected that to blossom into the Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce thing. I don't know. Maybe Tate McRae is not a big enough pop culture star yet in America, like she is in Canada. But yeah, having an NHL player date a celebrity like that is certainly helps.
That doesn't help. That doesn't hurt, rather. Last thing, because it relates to this too. I found it interesting. I'm not sure if you wrote the story or if someone else did in a different publication, even around how the respective leagues were really proactively pushing and telling and even helping their players be ready to create content. And when they were in Milan and Cortina, like show us what you're doing or create content, create TikToks, but post on Instagram. How did that come together? How did that play out? And is it still this overall thesis that more social media engagement will lead to more fandom, more viewership, and all the things will rise up as a result?
Well, the funny thing is that the NHL teams, as you know, if you were following any NHL teams during the Olympics, like they couldn't themselves tweet highlights, for
They were using
example.
like stick figures or bobbleheads or whatever.
However, NHL, the players, the Olympic athletes, the IOC in recent years has given them more latitude to post content from the game. So you saw a lot of NHL teams, retweeting stuff that their players posted because they couldn't really post it themselves. It makes sense why teams would, want to encourage players to, post stuff on social media, especially from the Olympics, because of how limited they were in their own ability to post content. But I think that in particular is something that the NHL is going to push to change in future games. But yeah, I think all of and obviously as well as anybody through your work at Greenfly, like how it's important to enable players to share stuff on social media and give them the tools to build their brand on social media.
And ultimately, to like encourage them, to make and give them permission. Like it's okay to put yourself out there being front and center. Like even though they've been told the opposite their whole career, deferring to others or not standing out from the crowd. And it's okay to do that.
And I think, like look at, I'm an Islanders fan. And under the previous regime, I guess you could call it, under Lou Lamoriello, the players were very limited in terms of their ability to do public appearances and do promotional stuff during the season. And since they changed their leadership this past summer, they've been doing a lot more behind the scenes content, and they've just done such a great job, like putting Matthew Schaefer out there, and obviously the fact that he's been a generational talent on the ice hasn't hurt, but just the whole kind of vibe around the team has changed just by the organization kind of giving players and themselves giving fans more access. So yeah, I think that's sort of the formula going forward
Yeah,
for the NHL.
it's a great insight, especially coming from someone who from an Islanders fan, straight from the source. I love that. One last thing before we we'll share a little stat, Alex. I guess we can keep this as long or short as you want. I like this question. For both soccer and hockey, we can touch both of your beats. What are the stories that they or yeah, what are the stories or storylines or narratives that they would want you to be telling right now? If they could take over your beat for a moment and say, this is I'm assigning you to write this story, you're gonna follow it to a T. What are the things that they wish you would write about more, or what are the things that they would want you to be putting out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think with soccer, it's sort of that young fan, the younger demographic that they tout, and that sort of diverse fan base that they can tout. Any time that you can find a way to include something about the demographics of their fans or the growth of their fans, MLS PR is very happy. On the hockey side, I mean, I think the thing they're pushing more than anything is sort of the young crop of stars, with and they've got kind of multiple generations of them at this point in the league, with sort of the McDavid, MacKinnon, Matthews generation were the young guns, and now they're sort of like the mid-career guys, and now you've got these young guys like Celebrini, Bedard, and Schaefer. So yeah, I think the young talent is definitely something that they like to emphasize, and obviously, like when it comes to their pitch to advertisers and marketers, it's a lot about they have the most tech savvy fans. They have kind of higher income fans, and that is something that they like us to emphasize.
That's great insight there. And yeah, I'm like picturing, I remember some of the more recent like NHL commercials, like putting some of those young guys in place or whatever, showing them in cubicles and talking about things like that. And you can see that the efforts out there to make sure that they're putting faces to these names and growing those player brands. Really fun stuff, Alex. We're gonna have some fun with you coming up in our sidebar segment. First up, shareable stat coming up right now. Just really interesting stuff, being able to pick the brain of Alex Silverman, again, reporter covering hockey and soccer for SBJ. Just so fascinating to hear about, how you take into all this information and what the leagues want you to play up and what they don't want you to play up, and and how to think about, what these metrics are that matter. Like, it doesn't matter if something is really popping off on social media if it's not translating into the more bottom line business metrics and vice versa. Just really fascinating stuff. But we're having more fun with Alex in our sidebar segment. First episode's shareable stat. This is a shareable stat comes from a recent study by an agency called Egencia, and also a hat tip to Alex Coppolo and his SponCon Sports newsletter, where he cited this stat and had me thinking for sure. So subscribe to that newsletter if you're not already subscribed. It's one of my favorite reads of the week, every week out. And this episode's shareable stat has to do with YouTube. In particular, this stat that Egencia found in their study is nearly 40% of views happen more than 30 days after a video goes live. So over a month later, you're still almost getting nearly over a third of your views are still to come. And so what does that mean? Well, it means a lot of things. First off, don't take that first 24 hours, 48 hours, whatever it might be, to be the be-all end-all of your YouTube video, especially if you're optimizing the right way, promoting the right way with shorts and all that as well. And also, of course, where this agency came into a picture just as much was about working with creators and influencers and what that means of, A, not just making sure that videos are left up long, and this might be just for YouTube, but certainly could apply to Instagram and TikTok and elsewhere as well. But also when it comes to reporting, is it does it make sense to report on a video when it's only a couple weeks old, let alone a few days old? Or when you're looking at, weekly or monthly or even a season-long report, are there videos that have had enough time to marinate before you to really understand what the true value is? And how can you identify videos that are accruing a lot of those views a little bit later? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Do you want that to be the case? If so, how can you optimize toward videos to increase the long tail of those views as well? So I can talk about this and think about this for days. I hope you will as well. Again, it's a typical shareable stat, nearly 40% of views, according to this study by Agentio, Agentio, and hat tip to the SponCon Sports newsletter. Nearly 40% of views happen more than 30 days after a video goes live. All right, that's a shareable stat. Think about it, talk about it, ponder it, take action on it. More importantly, stick around because lots more good stuff. You definitely want to hear this with the sidebar segment with Alex Silverman of Sports Business Journal. I am back with this episode of Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Alex Silverman. He is a reporter for SBJ, Sports Business Journal, covering hockey and soccer. We dove deep into each of those subjects in the interview portion. Are you now ready to compose some sidebars, Alex?
Yeah, let's rock and roll.
All right, number one. This is going to be a fun one. So you mentioned writing for the paper at Missouri, the Columbia Missourian. So tell me the most memorable story you wrote for the student paper back in college.
Yeah, the one that comes to mind is actually not a sports story. I was dispatched to a small town called Sedalia, Missouri, to cover a tornado that had come through there. And, coming from New York, I had never experienced a tornado, or really any kind of natural disaster at that point. This was, pre-Hurricane Sandy. So just seeing the destruction was crazy, and I ended up, walking up to this house that, the roof had been completely blown off, and these people, this family was just standing in their kitchen, but there was no roof on it, drinking Bud Lights, and the wife, obviously she wasn't drinking. She was, 8 months pregnant. And just kind of telling these people's story and just about how they were kind of adapting to this situation where their house had been destroyed, and they were kind of taking it in stride. So that one really stands out.
Well, if nothing else, like especially as you've gone into a career in sports and sports business, like keeps things in perspective. As much as we like talk about TV ratings and who's gonna win the championship, it's like there are also bigger things going on besides. And we're still reporting on a game at the end of the day.
100%.
Number two, we didn't talk too much about the women's professional soccer in particular with NWSL, but there's also the Gamebridge Super League, which is a challenger that's out there, and they have a lot of good players. They have some media out there as well. So just tell me like what you see for the future professional women's soccer in the U.S. Like, are we ultimately going to have this NWSL as long as the game as well as the Gamebridge Super League a kind of coexistence? Is it ultimately going to lead to a merger, or is a winner take all type thing?
Yeah, I mean, as I'm sure the Gainbridge Super League is part of the USL ecosystem, and the USL ecosystem is really in my 4+ years covering the business of soccer. One thing that I'm still trying to wrap my head around is the business model of USL. It's just very different than some of these other leagues. It's very much the league office sort of operates almost independently of the clubs. They get like a franchise fee from the clubs, and then the clubs kind of do their own thing. As far so it's just kind of a different model than what you see with NWSL, where it's kind of all everyone's kind of pushing in the same direction to a certain extent. But I don't necessarily think the Super League has enough traction yet to talk about it as a serious competitor to the NWSL. I think right now they're still trying to establish themselves. I don't know that I don't know that a merger is viable for them
Yeah, I wouldn't
necessarily.
think so.
Yeah, I think it's just the NWSL has just become a, like, massive business now with the expansion fees that we're seeing. So they're sort of just, even though they're both technically Division One leagues, NWSL is sort of in a league of its own.
Yeah, I mean, the NWSL brand is certainly a lot more elevated. If you were to ask a USL, both whether it's men or women's side, with a straight face, like does USL see themselves as competitive with MLS in the future? Like, do they have eyes on that, or do they ultimately see themselves as like we're the B league to MLS's A league in the US?
Yeah, it's a hard question. I think with USL, their push for launching a Division One men's league and doing promotion and relegation, I think they see themselves as kind of having a unique value proposition because, you know, they see themselves as being more authentic to what global soccer is with having that pyramid and you know, having clubs that are kind of can establish more of their own identity. But yeah, I don't think they have any illusions that they're necessarily going to like dethrone MLS or NWSL.
Yeah, I mean,
I think honestly for them, like the bigger concern maybe is MLS Next Pro and whether, you know, that's you know, a sort of a lower division league with the backing of MLS can kind of cut into some of the markets where they're trying to establish themselves.
right. I mean, hell, we didn't even get into it around like the other leagues out there, like the Kings League, which is starting to make headway in the US and.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing to watch, some of these non-traditional soccer competitions.
Totally. That's for our next episode, Alex.
Yes.
Number three. This one can go in any direction you like. I'm curious about it. Tell me the most impressive person you come across in your reporting over the years, for whatever reason. Just someone that after you met them or saw them speak or spoke with them, you're like, damn, this person is off the wall.
It's really hard to pick one, but you know, working at SBJ, like we have the privilege of a lot of high profile people coming through the office, you know, when they happen to find themselves in Charlotte, or sometimes they'll make a trip here specifically to visit us in the office. And early in my SBJ career, Jerry Jones came by the office,
Wow.
and I'll just never forget, I was at a conference table with, I don't know, there may be 10 of us, and he just had this way of making it seem like he was talking directly to you while he was addressing everyone. And I don't really know exactly how he did it, but it was just, you know, it just really stuck with me, how personable he was and how kind of folksy he was while, you know, obviously he's got an edge to him, but,
Sure.
you know, that one really stands out. Another one of those visits from my kind of early SBJ days, Tom Garfinkel from the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah.
Just seeing the business that they've built down there with the Formula One race, the tennis tournament, and obviously everything they've done with the Dolphins and Hard Rock Stadium. I find what he's done very impressive as well.
Yeah. I just so cool the people that you get to come across in your work. And I mean, just any other day you could be talking to Don Garber, the commissioner of MLS, or some billionaire owner of a team. It's just so what a cool opportunity to
Yeah.
be in your role. Number four is something else we didn't touch on that I definitely is I think is an underappreciated aspect of soccer in the US, even let alone Mexico. What should we know about Univision, about TUDN, and how much viewership Liga MX really does command when it comes to games and sports?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think it starts with obviously Liga MX being the most viewed soccer league in the US on television. So I think a lot of people, even myself sometimes when I'm talking about how, you know, the discourse around soccer is dominated by the European leagues, you know, somebody will say, well, what about Liga MX? And I'm like, yeah, you're right. That's, you know, the Hispanic population in this country, you know, over indexes in their love of soccer, and it shows in their ratings on Univision for Liga MX. And kind of the whole league, all Liga MX is just such a fascinating, I can go down a rabbit hole on Liga MX, but just the way that their media rights are kind of, each team sells their own media rights, and there are different your US networks that carry different Liga MX teams. I mean, Univision has the majority of them, but Telemundo has the Chivas rights, and Fox Deportes has a few teams as well. So, you know, that whole ecosystem is really interesting. And one sort of kind of up and coming trend that I'm watching with Univision and TUDN is the increased cooperation that they're having with DAZN. DAZN sub-licensed Club World Cup rights from Univision, or sorry, Univision sub-licensed Club World Cup rights from DAZN, and then DAZN sub-licensed UEFA Champions League rights from Univision. So yeah, curious to see if there might be more to that partnership in
Yeah.
going forward.
It's just such an underappreciated aspect, and we can go down a whole nother rabbit hole of how MLS and it looks at Liga MX. And so as you're watching the World Cup this summer with friends or family, just bust out that factoid that Alex shared with us, that the most watched league in the soccer, domestic soccer, not domestic soccer league in the US is Liga MX or Liga MX. I love that fact. Number five, this is an issue. Obviously, we're focused mostly on US related stories, but tell me the European football club or league story that has most interested you and why.
So, maybe it is my ethnocentric approach to the space, but it does kind of involve a US company, which is relevant. But just the way that they've gone from sort of being this tour operator for, European teams coming to the US with
And for
the
listeners who are a little confused or viewers, Relevant is the actual name of the company, not
correct.
like
Relevant
Relevant as in
Sports
the
is the
adjective.
name of the company. They are actually owned by Steven Ross from the Dolphins. But they started out as sort of a tour operator for these European clubs coming over to the US, and now they have kind of pivoted and morphed into, basically a commercial rights powerhouse. They sell all the commercial rights for UEFA Champions League now globally. So how they've come into that position has been something that's really interesting to follow. They represent the La Liga here in North America and Bundesliga. So it's a US angle, I guess, but on European soccer. But yeah, that company and what they've been doing is something that's really fascinating me in the European space.
Yeah, that's a great call out. That they have grown. I mean, were they the ones that originally were had the International Champions Cup? Is that how they started?
Correct.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, yeah, what an interesting growth story. Really doing incredible things to bring European soccer to the U.S.
Yeah, we had a story on their kind of evolution in December in SBJ, so just a little bit of a plug there.
Yeah, there we go. Look it up. I will link it up. Number six. I'm fascinated by this one. What does the ceiling look like for the NHL? I mean, the NHL is they're not going to become bigger than the NBA or NFL, obviously. So what do you see that as the ceiling is for the NHL? And also, in what other countries should we know about where NHL or its domestic league is the most viable? Like, does Finland's league really do well? Or Sweden's league, is that the biggest league in their country? So, ceiling for the NHL overall, and both US and globally, as well as what other countries that were domestic and/or NHL hockey over indexes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that I could answer this. I mean, I think one major way the NHL will grow is, Gary Bettman always says, yeah, we're at 32 teams, but seven of them are in Canada, so we're only in 25 US markets. So they see a lot of US markets that they could still go into with expansion. I think Houston and Atlanta have been the ones that have gotten the most buzz for potential expansion, but there are definitely others. Maybe going back to Arizona, Portland, whatever. So I think part of their growth story will include further expansion, and then growing the game globally. I mean, yeah, there are countries you mentioned where they're kind of a powerhouse, like Finland, Sweden, Scandinavia, essentially, but they really, I think, want to grow in Western Europe. You saw it with them partnering with Serie A to kind of build momentum in the Italian market around, ahead of the Milan Olympics. One thing I'm really curious to see is, and this could end up looking like a stupid prediction, like by the time this comes out, because we could find out about World Cup of Hockey cities for 2028 any day now, but they've said they're going to do one to two North American cities and one European city. I think a lot of people assume the European city is going to be Stockholm or Helsinki or somewhere in sort of one of their traditional hotbeds, but I think they might have an opportunity to go to a place like London or like a Western European country where they can really seek to grow appreciation for the sport. And much bigger markets. I mean, those markets that we're talking about, that where they're already big are, relatively small markets. But you look at a market like the UK or France, Italy, like those are much bigger markets that I think they want to try and get a piece of.
Yeah, no, that's a great call. I mean, we've seen like the global games have helped as well, bringing them overseas. I mean, heck, we had, you know, there were teams that were in Australia not that long ago, and so they're getting out there with these exhibition tours, and maybe one day they'll get a, you know, a Chinese player will become big in the NHL, and that can help, you know, lift up those markets as well. It's lots of opportunities to see, and I like the talk about, you know, domestic expansion as well, and some of the cities you called out, which should be exciting, because I think those are coming. All right, number seven for you, Alex. This should be a good one. Tell me the most memorable game you've ever attended, and also the most memorable conference panel that either you were part of or you witnessed.
Quite a few memorable sporting events. The one that I guess I would call out was the last game in Nassau Coliseum, game six of the Eastern Conference Finals. I think it was 2022 with the Islanders beating the Lightning in overtime on Anthony Beauvillier, game winner. The fans pelting the ice with beers after the game winner. It was just the most raucous
And they
scene.
didn't want to leave too. If I remember correctly, they just stayed there for forever.
And obviously you know it didn't work out in game seven, but you know I can't think of, really short of winning a Stanley Cup, I can't think of a better way for that historic building to go out.
Yeah.
Just such a great, so many great memories for me there. Most memorable conference panel. I would probably say, I think the first time that I saw Don Garber and Eddie Q speak together after the Apple deal, because there was just so much intrigue and so many questions. You know, I don't even necessarily remember it, how much insight came out of it, but just the level of excitement to hear these two guys talk about this partnership that was pretty unprecedented,
Yeah.
you know, really stands out as a lot of buzz.
Yeah, I mean, just one of the biggest sports stories really in years, and still playing out, of course, as well. Number eight, it's time for our food question. I always ask our food question. Tell me the best meal to get in New York and where to get it, and also the best meal you've had down there in Charlotte and where to get it.
Pretty basic with me when it's New York, it's always about pizza and bagels. So Joe's Pizza is my go-to spot in New York, and you know, anywhere I can get a bacon, egg, and cheese on a toasted everything bagel, you know, that's probably the thing that I miss most about living in New York. Here in Charlotte, there's a place right by my house called Alexander Michael's. It's kind of an old pub that's, you know, one of the kind of the older restaurants in Charlotte, and they've got this Cajun pasta dish called the What It Is that you know, I don't even look at the menu when I go in there anymore. I just, you know, that's what I get. So that would be my shout out in Charlotte.
I like it. Some good ones there, eating well. Charlotte has some good food, and of course, New York can't beat the pizza and bagels for out there for sure. Number nine, we didn't touch on this just in general in journalism overall. Just tell me how to use AI in your job, how are different many ways there are, and how do you see AI kind of affecting the future of journalism in general?
Yeah, it's funny because it's one of those things where, like a lot of people, I'm concerned and a bit of a doomer in terms of like the societal impacts of AI, but at the same time, it's impossible to resist the benefits of how it can, you know, make you so much more efficient and with your work. So, I mean, for me, I've had it, you know, I'll upload the new NHL collective bargaining agreement into there. You know, it's 300 pages,
Yeah.
and say, what is it? You know, what does it say about this? You know, which section should I look at to see about this? Or, you know, upload the old one and the new one and say, you know, compare the revenue sharing system in the old CBA versus the new CBA.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, very, you know, I guess maybe you've asked other reporters about this, or you're just smart about it, but FOIA requests, like it's, I did a story recently that I was really happy with about the contracts for FIFA's contracts with universities and for their to use their facilities as training sites, base camps during the upcoming World Cup. And without AI, I probably wouldn't have gone to the effort of writing, 20 FOIA requests for all the different public universities that were, submitting their facilities to be used as base camps, and as a result, ended up getting some good information about how much FIFA was paying those facility, those colleges to use their facilities. So yeah, I think honest, I'd probably use AI, I think, more than a lot of my colleagues. Yeah, it's just when it comes to, thick documents or, writing requests and stuff like that, I think it's really, really useful. And as far as how it affects the future of journalism, I don't know. I mean, it seems like you're seeing a lot of jobs, a lot of jobs, could potentially be replaced by AI. But like you said earlier, I mean, jobs, reporting jobs to a certain extent do depend on relationships. And, so I think if you're able to forge those relationships or you have a unique voice, then, you should be okay to, not be replaced by AI.
I got hope for you and many others, Alex. That's for sure. And it really fascinating to hear about the use cases with AI for you. And it's like it makes it that much more realistic and feasible to find those like needles in a haystack or something that's buried in the fine print that it can help bring those things to surface. I love that.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, last one here to get you out on. I might have an idea with where you might go with the hockey part of this if you're biased. So tell me in 5 years. The most well-known soccer player in the world will be blank in the world, not necessarily US, and hockey and the most well-known hockey player will be blank.
Yeah, I think my answers might not be that interesting, but I think Lamine Yamal, it's hard to bet against him right now. And in hockey, obviously, I assume you think I'm going to say Matthew Schaefer. Definitely was one of the names I considered. I think I'm leaning towards Celebrini, just because he's, kind of a more dynamic offensive talent. He's kind of got an awesome last name that I feel like is, Celebrini. It's very kind of sticks with you. So
Totally.
I like him a lot, but I think in all these sports you're seeing younger and younger players having success at earlier stages in their careers. So for all I know, it could be someone who's
McKenna.
right. Yeah, it could be someone who's 15 years old right now, who's 20 in 5 years and is, the next generational superstar. So those would be my guesses right now.
Or if we really want to get in deep in the rabbit hole, it could be Austin Matthews if he's chasing down Alex Ovechkin in 6 5 6 years.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it could be. And it's funny. I think, we live in this era, the kind of the post monoculture era where, I don't think they'll ever necessarily be a hockey player as famous as Wayne Gretzky or a basketball player as famous as, LeBron and Jordan and Curry. I still think if you ask a lot of people, name a hockey player, they'd still probably say Wayne Gretzky. So, yeah, I think some of those legacy names might still ultimately carry more like brand equity.
Yeah, no, it's very, very, very astute. All right, Alex had a lot of fun in our sidebar segment. Your chance to take over the podcast and tell us your all-star follow. It can be a social media person, a newsletter, a podcast to tell us who they are and why they're following.
Yeah, so I mean, there are a lot of great reporters out there, but I figured I'd go a little bit deep with this one. There's this guy that I've been following. I don't know him personally on Twitter, Braylon Breeze, Braylon underscore Breeze, BREEZE. And he, if you're into hockey media minutia, this is the guy to follow. He'll tell you when there's a new score bug on ESPN or who the commentators are for all the national games. I've just really, and I think he's a college kid. I've really enjoyed his following him, and I think he just seems to be really obsessed with what he does, and I think that's sort of the formula for success today, like being really focused on a niche thing like that. So yeah, he would be my shout out.
That is awesome. Love some obscure shout outs, and we'll just check him out, and we'll link up his handle in the show notes. And how about you, Alex? Where can we find you as well as all things SBA across the web?
Sportsbusinessjournal.com, at SBJ on Twitter and Instagram. My personal is at Alex M. Silverman. That's on Twitter, LinkedIn. I don't use Instagram that much, but same handle on there. So at Alex M. Silverman.
Check him out. He's full of great stories, great articles, great information, and this is a big year for both of his beats. And follow SBJ on social as well. They've really done a tremendous job, especially the last year or so with Cammy taking over there behind the scenes. Just really enjoyed being able to pick your brain today, Alex. And thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Neil.